I'm Afshin Ratansi, and welcome back to Going Underground Broadcasting. Amidst the edge of a global economic calamity triggered by the Trump-Netanyahu war in Iran, we come to you from a Dubai which has seen itself becoming one of the main targets of the war, apart from military destruction of assets of Lebanon, Palestine, Iraq, Azerbaijan, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Kuwait, Bahrain, and Britain and the United States. Tomorrow was supposed to be a day that signaled global detente, the visit of Donald Trump to Beijing. Instead, Trump's war has seen massive geopolitical power transfer from Washington to Beijing, as well as an oil price bonanza for Russia, now the largest economy in Europe by PPP GDP. Billions have been affected economically and tens of thousands have been killed, wounded or displaced so far. It is the defining military action of this century, which will reverberate for decades. For BRICS multipolarity, it is seen as the death throes of US hegemony. For hawks in Washington, it's part of a multifaceted attempt to prevent the end of US empire that consolidated in 1945. Joel Rubin was US Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Legislative Affairs when Butcher of Libya Obama negotiated JCPOA nuclear talks with Iran. Under George W. Bush, whose wars killed, wounded or displaced tens of millions, he was a career State Department officer. He's also been Jewish Outreach Director to Bernie Sanders' presidential campaign, and he writes the briefing book on Substack. He's in Chevy Chase, Maryland. Joel, thanks so much for coming on Going Underground. Well, I better start by saying that by the time it's broadcast, Trump could have chickened out, he could have sent ground troops, Israel could have used nuclear weapons. Having said all that, I mean, why do you support the war in Iran?
Yeah, there's a lot of different outcomes there could we could envision, that's for sure. But I got to tell you, the Iranian regime, the Islamic Republic, really overplayed their hand, and not just on a strategic level. They slaughtered thousands of their own people in January of this year, and that's a bridge too far. And what we're seeing now with where you are, for example, in UAE, the missiles coming in, raining in on 9 Arab countries. Iran has attacked basically and bombed more countries in the Middle East in about 3-4 weeks than Israel has in 77 years, I think it is now at this point. And so it's just too far. We can't trust where they were heading. And I think that the action was necessary, not preferable, not ideal by any stretch, but this is what the Iranians were pushing for. And they overplayed their hand.
Yeah, I mean, on the slaughtering of people, it has to be said that even the New York Times has been talking about how the Israelis were well in there organizing these demonstrations and protests.
I wouldn't buy into that. I you know, when you talk to Iranian Americans here, for example, who are deeply connected to the people on the ground there and have a lot of family members, I'm not hearing that kind of argument. I'm hearing that this is part of a pattern of the Iranian regime going back.
Isn't that the problem? Isn't that the problem? You're talking to Iranian Americans is a bit like talking to,
yeah,
I don't know.
But
it's like talking to Iraqi dissidents during Saddam Hussein. They will exaggerate the
situation. It's like talking to Arab Americans about Israel-Palestine. It's like talking to European Americans about NATO. We want to know what's going on when people are connected and tied and have networks in there. But look, this wasn't the first time the Iranian regime slaughtered its own people. It didn't just happen for the first time in January. Every single election period after those elections, when people protested the theft of the elections, the Basij came out and massacred people. So they did it again in January, and they did it by the tens of thousands.
I should just say, I've lived in Iran during election periods, and I've never seen anything like that. But you said Iran has overthrown, you said it overplayed its hand. I mean, the Financial Times here says, Chinese leaders seek strategic gains from quagmire in Iran. Another headline, again, from the same paper. I'm not biased to the FT. It's difficult to get the press in Dubai because of the mail, maybe. Oil windfall gives Russia $150 million a day. I know it's costing the United States $2 billion a day. How have they overplayed their hand when the whole world is now suffering because of what Israel and the United States have done?
Well, because those are two separate issues. The Chinese and the Russians trying to leverage a war the United States didn't, of course. That's normal.
Russia didn't have to do anything.
That would be blind neglect. Iran's entire nuclear infrastructure has been breaking the boundaries that they itself said that they were going to observe. The same thing with their ballistic missile program as well, targeting Diego Garcia, which is twice the distance of what they had said just weeks before they had been testing missiles to reach. So Look, they overplayed their hand because they had an opportunity to come to a deal with President Trump, but not just President Trump, with President Biden for 4 years. And I worked on the JCPOA as an activist, a supporter of it, as well as in the administration and in President Obama's administration. And by the way, notice how you called President Obama a butcher, but aren't willing to call out the Iranian regime for butchering their own people. So I think that's unfortunate.
No, we can do a whole program about Libya, of course.
But you know, I think you got to call a spade there with the Islamic Republic and what it did to its own people. But what I will say on this, the Islamic Republic did not come back into the nuclear deal when it had the opportunity with President Biden many times. So that is a hot political topic, as you know better than anybody in Washington. That was not an easy position for President Biden to take, and he got essentially pushed away. And then again, more negotiations. And the ask is still the same. That's what's so confounding and hard about this. And I will say that war is not a panacea. It's not. I'm not a neocon. I don't believe that every single war is going to lead to utopia. No. But what the Iranians are now still dealing with is the question, do they want to give up their nuclear program to have peace? And that's what's, again, being put on the table.
Okay. I mean, a couple of things there. You said that, I mean, if we assumed that what you were saying was correct and that Iran was slaughtering its own people, why does that give the right of the United States in any way, possibly, to start bombing Tehran and kill its leader? You know that this is the supreme crime, the supreme international crime as defined at Nuremberg is what the United States has committed, the crime of aggression.
First of all, if you're going to bring up Nuremberg, then we're going to go down a whole other level of legal international law. And I don't think the Islamic Republic could be
You back the war for two reasons, right? You back it for the slaughter after the nuclear program, right? It's the nuclear program
What I'm saying, let me make sure, because I want to make sure I'm very clear. Iran overplayed his hand on the diplomacy. It went too far. The troops, the American military apparatus that was stationed outside of Iran for many weeks was part of that negotiation strategy. The Islamic Republic negotiators decided that they would not take what was being offered as a deal. And concurrent to that, they had just slaughtered their own people by the thousands, which to me implies lack of goodwill. And that's the point. It was not an intervention to stop a slaughter, although, of course, there's a whole debate about responsibility to protect and can we do that? And then there are people arguing cutting off aid to Israel to stop the Gaza war, you name it. But in this instance, what I'm lining it up with is this is a regime that not only did not take an opportunity for a diplomatic off-ramp, but also demonstrated a violent capacity against its own people that led to what we can say as a total breakdown and the situation that we're in right now.
Okay, so the main reason is the nuclear talks. In which case, so you're saying we should dismiss the fact that Trump himself reneged on the original JCPOA that you helped negotiate. Okay, but you said the nuclear talks.
No, go ahead. That I said the diplomacy. Now, look.
You know the Omani foreign minister. The Omani foreign minister has been absolutely clear that the deal was on the table.
The British, of all people, were this close. I don't know if that's credible or not. I'm not going to say the Omani.
So you don't believe the Omani foreign minister. You don't believe the national security advisor, and you don't believe Joe Kent, the head of counterterror.
No, you're going to put the argument that you want. I am not saying that. What I am saying is that there was no agreement made in those negotiations, and there may very well have been the Omani foreign minister who was the interlocutor. There was no direct talk in any heavy, serious way. And look, let's just be clear. The JCPOA, and I see a lot of misinformation out there, and a lot of people saying, well, Obama got this deal, the JCPOA, which I again supported. It was only focused on the nuclear program. There's a variety of other aggressive, militaristic, hegemonic activity that Iran has been engaged in for decades, not in the missiles alone, but also, for example, creating militias inside countries that it has no business creating them in and destabilizing those countries incessantly in order to attack Israel, Hezbollah, Hamas.
We can get on to that, but just try and focus in on one thing at a time.
Those are all part of the full picture. But again, why the trigger? Look, President Trump makes his own mind up. And he decided that he was not, with his pressure, going to get an agreement on any of those issues. And that's why he took the action that he did.
So clearly, when I was living in Iran, I've got to say a lot of people were critical of the leader, Khamenei, who Trump killed, because of his standing
up
for...
I think the Israelis killed him. I don't think the United States did.
Okay. Doesn't really matter to the Khamenei family.
Well, it does. It does. It makes a big difference.
But a lot of people were critical of him.
It makes a big difference on who did it.
I mean, it was a joint operation as defined by the Pentagon. But I just have to ask you, because
that's not accurate to do. A joint operation does not mean that they targeted, that the United States hit him.
Why does it matter?
I just want us why to does be, it matter? Us to be precise.
Netanyahu and Trump will both be at the Hague for it.
There are different incentives for different actors. And you can't begin to tell me that the Iranians have been a pacifist country towards the state.
Wait, I'm not even getting... No, just hang on a second. Let's keep it to the nuclear weapons, because that was your initial... I mean, you were talking about the subsidizing...
That's part of the picture.
Of alliances. Okay, but on the nuclear issue, it's clear that when I was living there and beyond that, there was a lot of criticism of the Iranian leadership from within Iran that Iran supported the fatwa of Khomeini that they shouldn't have nuclear weapons and they should have nuclear weapons.
Right.
Clearly, we haven't heard from, we don't know whether he's alive, the successor, the other Khomeini. Trump has replaced Khomeini with Khomeini, whether he still backs up that fatwa. Clear now that Iran...
Iran's only choice
now. And apart from the Strait of Hormuz and all of these asymmetric strategies, it must get nuclear weapons as quickly as possible to counter the Israeli nuclear threat.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up. I'm really glad you brought that up, because that's a great messaging point. And it's certainly one that I understand on a logical level. Also, the physical reality is that Iran has an enriched uranium since the June strikes, and it has less capacity today than it did in June. It hasn't basically enriched, according to some estimates out there, for the first time in two decades. So I understand your point. It's a fair point. The will, the desire, does that mean the possibility is there? I would beg to differ that it's likely now. Like, there are people who make the argument, well, now because all your infrastructure is gone, it's likely you're going to get a bond. That's like somebody blowing up my house and say, well, now I really want a bigger house, so it's likely I'll get it because they did that, and now I can get a bigger one because of the insurance payout. Well, maybe, maybe not. And so I understand the message. I think the reality is that the Islamic Republic spent billions of dollars on its nuclear program that was illicit, that was sanctioned by the world, sanctioned by the UN, that Russia, China, NATO, our EU allies and partners, we all saw... Both parties, both D's and R's, saw that as an extreme threat and danger to the Middle East, in addition to our allies in the UAE, in Qatar, in Saudi, and the like, who, by the way, are none too happy with getting bombed by Iran unprovoked. And so that nuclear program was a problem. And the Iranians, the fatwa said they weren't building it. Fine, that's what they said. Then why were they enriching up to 60%? What were they doing with up to a dozen bombs worth of material?
Joel Rubin, I'll just stop you there. More from Obama's Deputy Assistant Secretary of State after this break. Welcome back to Going Underground. I'm still here with Obama's Deputy Assistant Secretary of State, Joel Rubin. Joel, you were talking about nuances and complexities of what Iran's response was, should be arguably, to this current war as regards nuclear weapons. Of course, other people in Iran may be saying, why is it a member of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty in the first place, which started the whole JCPOA thing ruling? But perhaps it doesn't even need nuclear weapons. Can't it just use the Khorram Shah Iranian missiles to attack the Dimona reactor? So far, it has shown that Israel has no protection over Dimona, the site of the nuclear weapons program in Israel. Should we be expecting Iran to target it? Because Israel is defenseless.
First of all, Israel's shot down, I think, over 90% of the missiles that have come in. Dimona was hit, but Dimona's a town. there's a facility in Dimona, the town, that is nuclear, to your point. Yes, that is the facility. That was not hit. The town was hit. Civilian areas are actually being hit. Iran almost hit the old city, almost blew up the Dome of the Rock. That would have been pretty bad.
I mean, it's terrible. Civilian areas are getting hit all over. So the GCC, I'm not sure, and in Iran,
I'm not sure why
hospitals and schools.
Areas.
Hospitals and schools, as we know.
Look,
no, but specifically,
you're advising the
Iranians.
But the Dimona question, let me get to your Dimona point about the nuclear. It's a fair point question, right? They have ballistic missile capabilities, they meaning the Islamic Republic, and they have certainly shot a significant number. They did back in June. They have now in this war, they have demonstrated capacity to go further, even potentially up to Europe. This is why the international community at the United Nations has consistently identified their ballistic missile development as a threat and a problem for global security.
Huh? The ballistic missile program wasn't on the JCPOA list at all. You weren't negotiating about that at all.
No.
And what?
No.
So what do you want Iran to be? Completely defenseless? To have no deterrence at all?
No, it's interesting. I don't think that ultimately, if there is an agreement, that to your point, it was not part of that JCPOA. There are people in Washington who think that there should be no ballistic missiles at all. I actually think that that's kind of an unrealistic idea for a nation state to have zero defense, right? I just don't buy it. But there should be rules and constraints, and they should be missiles that can't just do what we're doing now. What we're seeing now, that is Iran essentially bombing everybody. Right. It's like unstrapped and it's bombing all over the place to try to create pressure and political pressure. It is actually, there are two fronts for this war, right? There's the on the ground military, and then there's the global opinion. And within that, you have the diplomatic pressure, you have the economic pressure. That is part of the strategy for the missiles. But ultimately, the missiles were not part of that nuclear arrangement, which is why President Trump, and I opposed his viewpoint, but it's why he did not like that nuclear deal. So it's another layer of complexity to this, and I think it has to be hashed out that they can't have, Iran cannot have missiles. They can just threaten Europe overnight and threaten all of the Arab Gulf.
But why should the United States have missiles that can threaten this region? I mean, who is going to stop the?
Look,
you see, these are the questions being asked all around the world right now. Why?
Yes.
What gives the United States the right to commit the Supreme Act war crimes? All around the world, one after another. I mean, it's usually defeated
ever since
Vietnam. But why? And that's the question being asked. Is that not going to be the legacy of the war?
I'm not going to argue about every single war around the world. I'm not going to talk about Russia and Ukraine. I'm not going to talk about Afghanistan and Russia and the United States and Gazelle and other wars and the genocides in Africa and the massive amounts of people that have been killed in Syria, the 600,000 people. I'm going to talk about this war right now. And in the United States, we have allies across the Arab Middle East and in Israel and in Turkey and in Azerbaijan. All there. Those are allies, right? Like, they're just allies. They're not clients. They're allies. And they provide a variety of support to the United States and we to them. And they are at risk from Iran. They look at Iran. The Islamic Republic didn't just show up one day. It's been under the watch of the international community for decades as a threat to regional and global security.
Yeah, I just don't think you should use the word international community.
We didn't create this out of thin air.
There's another way of understanding it. And I think even so-called mainstream media in the NATO nations are saying it, is traders placed $580 million in oil bets ahead of Trump's social media post. That's the post the other day, which... Trump said, look, okay, you're not going to, Iran, you're not going to do what I want you to do. In fact, over the past 10 days, and news could have changed by now, but it was like 48 hours to meet our demands, Trump said. Iran went, no. Trump went 5 days of negotiations, no. Trump said, 1 month ceasefire, Iran said, no. Trump said, we'll send U.S. troops, Iran said, come closer. But anyway... What about the fact that people say all around the world, it's not even to do with Israel and Miriam Adelson's bankrolling of money? It's just pure corruption. You live in a corrupt country, bankrolled by the military-industrial complex and bankrolled by massive oil bets that can be done in this way, which ultimately will lead to the end of the petrodollar. It's all about money. I don't know. You obviously didn't make any money on it because you didn't think he was going to do it.
Yeah, I'm just a loyal civil servant to the American taxpayer when I served. Look, if you want to talk about the dynamics here in the United States and corruption, hey, I'm happy to talk about that. I'm not going to speculate those. That's the motivator for this. I'm going to go back to...
It was 15 minutes before that the bets were put, before Trump made the post on Truth Social. What do you think? What's your hunch?
What's my hunch? You know, look, I can't get in the minds of people who are on Polymarket. I don't like corruption. If there is, I think hopefully when we Democrats take the House, at least there'll be investigations into questions about all these issues related to contracts and whatnot. But I don't play stock in conspiracy theory.
So what was so you really believe that the Omani foreign minister, the British National Security Advisor, they're all talking nonsense and there was no deal on the table and they had to do it because it's about nuclear talks.
Okay, let's be very clear. What they said is what they said. That's fine. But I do not believe that there is a corruption angle that makes us decide that we are not going to listen to the Omanis or the British. And what they said after the fact, and even maybe during it, may have been correct, may not have been correct. I don't know. I wasn't in the room, but I'll tell you who wasn't in the room. The Americans and Iranians together. And there was no deal and there was no agreement. And this was not like some new thing, Afshin, you know this. Nuclear negotiations started during the Bush administration. I mean, we're talking 20 years of negotiations, the P3 process, the later on then President Obama and his process, and then even Trump with his maximum pressure a little off, but there were some talks and then Biden again. This has been a 20-year dynamic. All of a sudden, if one person says, oh, look, there really was a deal, call me skeptical. I want to actually see the deal. I don't necessarily believe that because one person there watching it says there was a deal, but nothing has been signed, that's accurate. But to the question of corruption, look, we always have to root out corruption. I mean, I have a feeling that the Islamic Republic leaders are billionaires sitting on massive wealth that they've stolen from the Iranian people.
Wait, so...
I'd love to look into that.
So the Islamic Republic leaders are corrupt, therefore...
Why are they doing what they're doing around the region? Who knows how much money they're pocketing, you know?
I'm not sure.
How much are they skimming the oil sales?
Sorry, Joel, even if that was true and your Iranian-American friends are telling you it is, that wouldn't justify the corruption on the other side. So I don't see the relevance of it.
It's just logic, right? Like maybe they have a good war economy. I mean, who knows? There's a whole subject matter policy area in Washington and around the world called terror finance. Terror finance is essentially tracking illicit money going to terrorist organizations.
Yeah, but the world is thinking like terror finance as in the finance of your government, as in personally, the members of your government. You're a Democrat, right?
Paying for groups to commit terrorist attacks against civilians, that's terror finance. How'd that money get there? Not through normal Wells Fargo wire transfers, I'm sure of that.
Even John Stewart, interrogating, I think it was a Biden person, you must have seen it the other day, showed how terror financing works in your country. The United States, when you were perhaps in government, who knows, was financing ISIS, Daesh, and Al-Qaeda. Were you not?
Yeah, that's true, right? Like there was, you know, not many, and I'll say, I don't know about my department, maybe some other agencies, but all that goes through an appropriations process and all that goes into the laws signed by the president, and all of that has oversight by Congress. That's what's different. And I got to tell you, you're bringing up the question of corruption. I understand why not? But to me, it sounds like a conspiracy theory more than an actual point of policy.
Okay. This is the most unpopular war in American history, as has been widely said. It's 27% on Reuters Ipsos.
That's hard to know.
Worse than the Vietnam War as it was ending in 1973. Why do you think we haven't seen mass civil disobedience? And do you think that will it be the markets that stop Trump from continuing with this losing war? Or will it be mass civil disobedience?
At the risk of sounding academic about this, now it's not academic because war is death. The definition of war means people die. And that is a horrible, horrible way to spend our money. That's a horrible way for us to operate in the world. People should not die. We should not be looking for wars. And we should not be supporting wars unless a threat is present. But I'll tell you, 3 to 4 weeks into a war, Vietnam was 15 to 20 years. I served during the war in Iraq. I was in the Senate as a Democrat fighting against the war in Iraq. I remember every day we were doing body counts of how many service members had been killed in Iraq. That was a multi-year situation. We are several weeks in. I don't think the American people are mobilized to oppose in the way you're asking, not only because of the shortness of time so far, but also a sense that this is not going to be a boots on the ground kind of military action that we've seen. Now, if it is, then I should come back in half a year, and if it's that long, and talk to you about this and what does that look like. But I think the American people, and now let's get political here. The Republican Party is 98% supportive of what's going on. The Democratic Party is 98% opposed to what's going on. The Splitsville right now is such that it sort of creates a dynamic where the president has tremendous latitude. What he does with that, I think, will have a direct impact on the American public's reaction. But right now, we're going to protest this weekend. We're going to protest coming up at some point, and we have them every several months, called No Kings, which is related to domestic policy. So it's not as if the American people aren't out there, and I assume this will be part of the language. But okay, just not sorry to interrupt, Joel. This war.
Sorry to interrupt, Joel. We want you on sooner than 6 months, I tell you, the way things are going. Just finally, very briefly, yeah. How is the United States, I mean, all those people, the ordinary American and the United States more generally going to cope with the end of the petrodollar? I mean, oil is flowing freely in yuan. Clearly, the rest of the world is going to price in yuan. What happens to how the United States feels about itself?
You're bringing up the Achilles heel of this entire action, something everybody's talking about. Look, I'll tell you, I personally criticize deeply President Trump's moves to get rid of USAID. They fired all of the energy staff at the State Department, the people who would have handled this issue and managed it much better. I heard yesterday on a discussion of $10 a gallon. This is bad. This is really bad. This is what hurts Americans, and it's what we pay attention to more than anything. And I think that's also why you're seeing flirting with an off-ramp. Not there yet, but I think that that is also a very significant part of the way the American people view the relevance and the value of this military action.
Joel Rubin, thank you.
My pleasure.
That's it for the show. Our continued condolences to all those bereaved by today's NATO nation wars of aggression. We'll be back on Saturday for continuing coverage of the Trump-Netanyahu war in Iran. Until then, keep in touch via all our social media if it's not censored in your country, and head to our channel, Going Underground TV on rumble.com, to watch new and old episodes of Going Underground. See you Saturday.